Fear makes them complicit. And what of those who do speak out? They are branded as anti-Semites and supporters of terrorism. George Washington University clinical psychology professor Laura Sheehy was pushed out of her job. The former head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, was denied a fellowship at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy because of his announcing genocide.
Alleged, quote,
of course,
anti-Israel
they do not intend to pay. They fear being attacked. They fear destroying their careers. They fear losing funding. They fear a loss of status. They fear persecution. They fear social isolation. This fear makes them complicit. And what of those who do speak out? They are branded as anti-Semites and supporters of terrorism. George Washington University clinical psychology professor Laura Sheehy was pushed out of her job. The former head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, was denied a fellowship at Harvard.
Welcome to Celebrating Bike Month, a collaboration between Chico Velo and KZFR. I'm Whitney Garcia, co-manager of Chico Velo. May is National Bike Month, and to celebrate, each week throughout the month of May, we'll release a new segment highlighting Chico's unique cycling community, giving listeners an opportunity to learn about biking in Chico, local bike infrastructure, and plans for future projects. We'll talk with local bike shops to help you with bike service or to find something new. We'll also focus on bike safety in the greater Chico cycling community. The folks we interview come from a variety of backgrounds and possess a diversity of skills and resources. But we all have one thing in common, and that is a love for bikes. With a long history in local cycling, every month is Bike Month for us. Chico Velo is excited to be here at the KZFR studios. This first interview will reintroduce Chico Velo, our mission, vision, values, and recent activities. Today, I'm joined by Chico Velo Board President Mandy McKay. Mandy, tell us a little bit about your background in Chico and how you got involved with Chico Velo.
I've been in Chico for almost 20 years. I went to school here at Chico State and then was really lucky to be able to stay on after graduating and find a job. So I've been part of the community for a long time. Biking has always been part of that life that I've had here and been able to build here. And it's one of my favorite things about living in Chico is that it is so easy and so conducive to riding bikes, whether for transportation or for recreation. So I very early on got introduced to riding a bike to school, lost it for a couple years, and then got reintroduced to it actually by my now husband, who was always really into bikes personally. And when he moved to Chico, he moved to Chico for the biking community. So it's definitely been part of my whole time, you know, living in Chico. And then Chico Velo specifically, I had heard about, I had been introduced to just through friends and other community members. So I'd followed it. I participated in the Wildflower Century many times. I'm a road cyclist, also a mountain biker, and also a bike commuter. So again, been kind of all over the place when it comes to biking in Chico. So again, been part of the Wildflower Century and heard about the organization. And at one point they were looking for new members and new board members. So I was interested and I applied really to kind of bring the voice around transportation and bike commuting. So they were already doing some work on that, but that's what I was interested in and why I wanted to join the organization. So I joined the board almost 10 years ago now and have been on the board ever since. I'm now serving in the president role of the board, which has been great. And it's been really fun to make sure the organization continues. And we've had some ups and downs, but I'm really proud of where its history and where it's come from and what we're about to do in the future.
Could you let our listeners know real quick what you do for your career outside of being the board president?
Sure. So my day job, I'm actually the environmental and social impact director for Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. which is a wonderful company, obviously, and I've been really grateful to work there for the last 15 years. And part of that role does involve kind of community engagement around alternative transportation. So the brewery is definitely supportive of bike infrastructure, and, you know, we've had bike parking available at the brewery for decades. And so it's just sort of part of the company's DNA as well, which is great.
Can you talk about how and maybe why Chico Velo was formed?
We've been around for about 40 years. Formally, though, since about 1986 was when it actually became a nonprofit. But prior to that, so we're talking around 1980, Chico Velo was a cycling club. It was really just a group of people that wanted to ride together and just enjoyed cycling, road cycling specifically. Soon after that, a few of the members just realized, hey, we're a riding club and we just want to go out and ride, but we might also have a voice here in the community to bring better infrastructure, to work with city council, to work with engineering, to work with other partners to improve bike infrastructure in the town. So that could lead to bike paths or better pavement, you know, potholes. So early on, there was this interest from those original, just that group of riders that felt like they could make a difference and start working towards better infrastructure. So many listeners might know and recognize the name Ed McLaughlin. So he was very much part of those early days, really the leader, first general manager for Chico Velo. And, you know, he really spearheaded a lot of the advocacy work that is really rooted in Chico Velo.
What is cycling advocacy? Could you define that for us?
So for me, it's two things. It's the education side and then also true advocacy. So I'll start with education. If we don't, you know, our mission is really just more people on bikes in general, right? We want to see more people riding, whether that's for transportation or recreation. And so the advocacy or the education side is critical, because if people don't understand why it's important to ride a bike, whether for your health or to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or to reduce traffic, all these things that can contribute to like a healthy lifestyle, better community, if they don't understand that, then advocating for bike infrastructure is not going to work, right? If people don't understand why it's such an invaluable part of a community. So the education piece is important. So it's safety education. It's understanding why infrastructure is important. You know, how do you ride a bike safely? Don't ride on the sidewalk. There's all kinds of those types of things that we work on. So that's one component of it. And then on the other side is that sort of true advocacy, where we are working directly with the city and making sure that the cycling, and I would say really active transportation, which includes pedestrians as well, that voice is coming through, you know, at city council meetings or in conversations about future projects. So that's, you know, we write letters of support, we work to gather feedback from the community, and then again, we bring that to where the conversations are happening about future projects, about infrastructure.
What are some examples of advocacy projects that you've seen be successful in your time as board director?
Prior to my time on the board, you know, Chico Velo was integral in things like pavement repair and potholes and kind of simpler things like that. And then especially bike paths being built specifically for bikes separate from the roadways. So that was something that Chico Velo helped develop, you know, prior to my time. Since I've been on the board, you know, we've been part of a lot of infrastructure projects where our voice, I would say we were an active part of bringing that feedback and specific design ideas and, hey, maybe not put bollards or, you know, those very specific things that only people that do ride or walk would have experience with. So that's the type of thing that we bring into those city conversations. So I think about the Bikeway 99 project. You know, that started 15 years ago. Velo was part of those workshops and those community engagement feedback sessions, bringing the voice of like, hey, connectivity is key. Yes, we should make sure that there's no gaps in this infrastructure. You know, some signage would be helpful. You know, bringing those specific components, which I would say the city in general does, there's some really good bike infrastructure in Chico, and the city should be proud of that. Because it's not easy to do, and I feel like they've done a really good job of trying to prioritize it among all the other things they're trying to do as a city. However, I would also say Velo's been, you know, we're one of the reasons why I think that stuff has been prioritized, is because we do have a strong foothold in the community. It's a very active bicycling, you know, city and town. So I think it's both. I think I've seen us be very helpful in bringing that voice to specific projects. And then I've also seen the city realize to prioritize it, and it is such an important part of the community.
Chico Bella has quite a few programs, is that right?
Yes, and I'm super proud and excited about our Trailworks program. So again, if you think about the history of Chico Velo, it was really in road cycling at the very early days, certainly around transportation. But then about 10 years ago, we embarked on a Trailworks program, and recognizing that we do have Bidwell Park, we do have mountain biking as a big component of cycling in Chico. And also recognizing that the city, due to a lot of reasons that they've not been able to recover from, has had to move away from a dedicated trails staff. So we used to have, they used to have staff members at the city of Chico that were dedicated solely to trails, which was great. Again, lots of challenges that they've had to navigate. And so we recognized at that point, they need help. We want to have good trails in town. We're also mountain bikers. So what can we do? And so I would give a lot of credit to another one of our board members, Thad Walker, who brought this idea to Chico Velo and said, hey, what if we started doing a stewardship program to not only take care of the trails in Bidwell Park and kind of give back to this wonderful resource that we have, but also see if we can improve them and maybe build different trails. And so we, again, over the last 10 years, have built a really strong relationship with the city. We are the only non-staff organization that's allowed to do work in the park on Bidwell Park trails, which took a long time to build that trust because, you know, the city takes that very seriously. Bidwell Park is a wonderful resource. They're not just going to let anyone go out there and change things. And so we've gone through extensive training, and we've worked with the city directly on making sure we got the right volunteer agreements in place. We know what we're doing. They have a trust in us and a confidence in us that now we know the techniques, the right way to brush a trail, the right way to maintain a trail, to make sure it's sustainable, make sure it's safer, that we maybe don't have as much erosion, and we're not letting our trails just erode every year in the rain. So there's a lot of work that we've done. And we're extremely proud of it because it's a very successful program. We have amazing crew leaders. Volunteers are coming out all the time to give back. They want to, you know, support our trails. So it's been wonderful. Hundreds of hours every year we put into those trails. And we've learned a lot to the point now that we're getting comfortable with even rock work and doing some slight trail repairs and reroutes and building actual features as opposed to just, you know, brushing it or kind of making sure the drains are there. So I've learned a ton about, you know, I was already a mountain biker, but I've learned so much about the proper way to take care of a trail and maintain trails through our Trailworks program. So it's been very successful. I'm really glad to have it under our umbrella. And it's just brought in a lot of community volunteers and support. And it's been really great.
How does Chico Velo Trailworks prioritize all users of trails, and how do we make sure that we're not just making trails better for mountain bikers?
We're not Mountain Bike Trailworks, right? We're just called the Trailworks program because we know, yes, we might be mountain bikers and a lot of our crew leaders are, but actually not all. And a lot of our volunteers are not mountain bikers. Bidwell Park is for all users. Again, I like to ride them, but I also like to run them and hike them. And so you've got to make sure that when you're building a trail, there's definitely differences in how you build or maintain a trail. If it's just going to be for mountain bikers, you might build it differently. If it's for multi-use, you know, everybody, again, dog walkers, hikers, runners, mountain bikers, you'd work on a trail differently. So you're not building jumps necessarily, right? Because that's not fun for a trail runner or a hiker. They don't want big jumps in their trail, and nor do I when I'm running or hiking.
Or when I'm biking in Bidwell Park, I don't want a kicker.
Good point. Not a lot of people even do on a mountain bike. So we absolutely take that into account, and our whole mission with Trailworks, in fact, it's literally written into our mission for Trailworks, is that it is for all users and multi-use, and the way Bidwell Park is set up to be where it's for everybody. And again, we're coming at it from, yes, we're a bike advocacy organization, but when it comes to trails, we're very much just wanting them to be sustainable and safe and usable by everybody.
Mandy, could you tell us about some of the other programs that Chico Velo has, like Adopt a Path or Bike Valet?
Yes. Bike Valley has been around a long time. It's become kind of a go-to for people at the farmer's market and even at some other large events around town. It's so great. And it kind of goes back to that advocacy question you asked earlier, because if the infrastructure is not there, if we're not encouraging and educating people on how it's convenient and easy and safe to ride a bike, we don't achieve our mission of getting more people comfortable to do it. And so Bike Valet makes it very convenient, safe, it's free, it's totally encouraging and advocating for people to ride their bike, because it'll be secured, you don't have to worry about it, you know, you don't have to lock it up, someone's going to watch it for you. And so that program's been around a long time now, again, probably more than a decade. You'll see it at Farmers Market and other large events, as even at Sierra Nevada. So Sierra Nevada is now offers the Our Bike Valet service there as well. And so that's been incredibly successful. We're hoping to grow that and expand that. And then Adopt-A-Path. So I mentioned Bikeway 99, and we've got some other paths that aren't necessarily part of Bikeway 99, but specific bike paths. We've also started the Adopt-A-Path program maybe 5 or 6 years ago, to encourage people that want to support bike paths, again, to make sure bikers have a place to like comfortably and safely get around town. If you want to ride your bike, those paths, it'd be nice if they're clean and if people feel safe going through them. So the Adopt-A-Path was really a way for people that wanted to give back. They can adopt a path. So I think we've got 6 or 7 adopted sections out. So a lot of, you know, Rotary has one, Sierra Nevada has one, Clean Canteen has one. They've been adopted by these organizations or these companies that just offer to keep them clean and maintain them a few times a year. And so also been very successful. And again, it's a way for organizations or businesses to give back. You know, maybe they can't give money, or maybe they don't have a lot of time to dedicate to Bike Valet or some of our other things, but they can pull together a cleanup once a month or once a quarter. And so that's another huge partnership with the city. They provide us with all the materials that we need. We just help organize the sponsors and the adopters, make sure those cleanups happen, and then promote those organizations as well. And so it's been really, really popular.
So we've talked about all of our programs, and we've talked about advocacy and the history, but there's one big part of Chico Velo we haven't touched on, that, and that is the Wildflower Century. that's our biggest fundraiser and also one of the largest road rides in Northern California. Can you tell us a little bit about the Wildflower and its history?
Yeah, so going back again, probably 40 years, it started as just a ride that people like to do. And I would say the original route is probably not, you know, it didn't have 7 routes back then. And but really, it was just a big ride that the local people wanted to do. And there's still a lot of those original sort of Chico Velo early members that are still riding with us today. They're still either part of the organization or they support it or donate in some way. So really cool to see. We have a lot of people still in the community that were around at the very start of when the Wildflower became a thing. So now what it's turned into, though, again, it was a ride that people just wanted to do on the regular, and it was like a big event. It has become pretty much our sole fundraiser for the organization. So for the last 25, 30 years, it has been how our organization stays afloat. So it's a fantastic event. It is showcases all that wonderful road riding that we talked about earlier, because we have so much of it here in Chico and Butte County. But it is, yeah, it's become our sole fundraiser. So 90% of the way our organization works for the rest of the year comes from revenue from the Wildflower. So it is a fantastic event. It's still, I think, one of the best centuries that I've ever been to, and I've done quite a few of them in California and other states. It's earned its reputation, and it also happens to be for a good cause, because it truly supports Chico Velo, literally. So yeah, it's coming up. And now, as you said, it's we've got 7 different routes. We still have all the good food that people are used to. You know, whether you're someone that's been riding a long time or you're just trying to get into it, there's a length route for you. So it really has become, hopefully, an accessible and just really great community event for people. And like I said, it also is for a good cause. So you can have a really good time, but also support all the work that we do the rest of the year. And we bring in, it's usually 200 to 300 volunteers that show up for this event, and they are at the rest stops, and they are helping you check in, and they're at the store, and they're doing everything. I mean, yes, we have to plan it, and it is a lot to plan, but it is a huge turnout from the community that is beyond appreciated. I have not been, I mean, I haven't been many places, but the places I have gone, I don't know of a more bike-friendly and bike-excited community. Like, there are people that under this, you know, Chico and the surrounding areas, like, really understands the role that active transportation, but also bicycle recreation plays in a community. It's extremely important. It's accessible to everybody, right? But it's also, like, it's so much part of mental health, physical health, alternative transportation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It hits all the boxes. And I think we've got, again, thanks to those early people, maybe around Chico Velo, but even prior to that, we've built such a strong community around it that I think it just keeps people going because it feels good. It's so fun. It literally builds community in lots of ways. So I think that's part of it. It's got to be.
There's really something for everybody. There's a 12-mile route, a 30-mile route, a 62-mile route, some 100-mile routes, and then the mega route, which is all the routes in one.
If you want it all, just go for that one.
Yes, if you want it all, and if you also want to taste every food at all the rest stops, that's the one to pick. So why do you think the Wildflower is important to Butte County, not just Chico's cycling community?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're still a pretty rural part of California, right? And I think that's the beauty of it. But also, I think the Wildflower showcases the amazing part that is truly Northern California, right? So when you talk to people about Northern California, they might just think of the Bay Area. They might go as far as Sacramento. But we're obviously 100 miles even more north than that, right? And so I think that's also part of bringing people to Butte County and showing them what we have here. So it is a great way to literally see and just kind of tour Butte County on a bike, and because it literally is taking you into, like you said, Oroville, Paradise, Sterling City, Durham. We're all over the place on the ride. So it's just a great way to see the whole county.
Do you have to be an avid bicycler to participate in the Wildflower?
Definitely not. I mean, that's part of why we have all those route options. I've seen people do long routes, like 60-mile route on a cruiser. That's, I don't know, awesome. How they're doing it, but they do it and they have a great time. So you literally could, you know, you can ride out to Durham and back, and it's flat. It's on a bike path the whole way. You can do it on a cruiser. We've got people coming out with Ability First, which is fantastic. They've got hand cycles and all kinds of things. So it's accessible to anybody. And we have the Childflower route. So if you've got kiddos, it's a great way to get them out on a bike. You can, you know, pull them along in a trailer, or if they're old enough, they could probably make it out to Durham and back, and it'd be a good ride for them. So we really have tried to make it, no, you don't have to be an avid cyclist. You do not have to be someone who rides their bike every day. The whole point, one, again, it's a fundraiser. One, we just want to see as many people on bikes as possible, and it's a good way to just try it out even if you're not an avid cyclist.
And Chico Velo puts out something called Pedal Principles that are hand-in-hand with our Wildflower registration. And those are safety guidelines and expectations of riders for how to have proper road riding etiquette. Because that's usually right. You're in a group, or you can be in a group when you're riding. Could you just briefly touch upon some of that road riding etiquette?
Yeah, we do want to make sure that people understand the Wildflower is fantastic. The community's used to it. But it's not closed, right? It's not a closed route, meaning you are not the only people on the road. So it's still open to vehicles, right? There's no traffic control that we're providing. So the pedal principles are there just to remind people, hey, yes, there's going to be a lot of bicyclists out, but you need to make sure you're riding single file, you're staying as far to the right as you can, you're following all traffic laws and rules of the road. So you do need to stop at stop signs, stop at stoplights. And again, just be respectful. And we have to actually share the road that day with vehicles, right? And so it's kind of a two-way reminding everybody, yep, we're doing this big bike event, so there's going to be lots of bicyclists out on the road, but we also need to make sure we're following all the rules of the road. And then also, you know, part of the pedal principles is make sure you got your water and a patch kit or a tire level or something, that if you do need to repair your tire in between rest stops, you can do that.
I understand there is now a Wild Fest accompanying the Wildflower. What is the Wild Fest about?
Yeah, Wild Fest is really just a party. Part of it was originally, you know, we do encourage anyone who is participating in the Wildflower to come on Saturday, check in, get your water bottle, get your wristbands, get all of those things done on Saturday so that you're ready to go first thing Sunday morning and you don't have to come check in with us, because a lot of people want to start early. So it started as a way to just check in riders ahead of time, but now it's really almost like a separate community event. So even if you are not participating in the Wildflower at all, you should come to the Wildfest, because we've got vendors, we've got food trucks, we've got activities, and there'll be things to do for the kids. It's really just a way to celebrate bikes and get people excited about the Wildflower, but also just bikes in general. And just, it's a fun community event that you don't even have to have anything to do with Wildflower or bicycling, but you can come and check out the vendors. There'll be stuff for sale, food. You can hang out. It's all for free. Sierra Nevada's Wildflower IPA will be there. So really, it's just come and hang out at the fairgrounds. It costs nothing to come and enjoy the day. If you happen to be also participating in the Wildflower, you can check in and do all those things during the Wildfest as well.
What are some of the positive changes you've noticed about cycling advocacy in California?
Well, I think this idea of complete streets is encouraging, because what it means is that when we design streets or redesign them, we are thinking about all its users, and we're thinking about all the ways people are going to interact or use that roadway, right? So instead of just thinking about vehicles and traffic, which we do have to think about, but it's also going to look at the people walking on the sidewalk, the bikes riding in the bike lane, delivery vehicles. All these things are coming in the conversation when we talk about complete streets. So what I'm excited to see at the state level is this push towards complete streets that does think about alternative transportation. And that's really for a variety of reasons. It's to improve public health. The more active we are in our transportation, the healthier we're going to be. But it's also there to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which improves air quality, which goes back to the public health, reduce traffic, encourage more economic vitality and business to places that do encourage active transportation. So I'm encouraged to see more of this conversation around complete streets and advocating for bikes as a real form of transportation. And I'm also excited to see there is a lot of movement on trails for mountain bikers, but also for all trail users. So that's been really encouraging to see. The other one I've been following and we've been keeping an eye on is the conversation around e-bikes, because they're such an important, if you are truly talking about alternative transportation, e-bikes are a great way to get out of your car, maybe save some money on gas, be much more efficient and easier to park, all those things, right? Like I'm encouraged to see all the people adopting e-bikes as a form of transportation. And that's also something that CalBike and others have really been thinking about. How do we make sure those are included in the conversation? What are also the safety precautions that need to come with e-bikes, right? How are they defined? So they already are, and they're going to keep being a really important component of this like future of transportation.
How does your background in sustainability help you lead Chico Velo?
When I think about my role in environmental sustainability, I am thinking a lot about how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions? What contributes to cleaner air and a more vibrant, healthy community? And I think a bike, it has all of those. So if I can, I'm classic, like I'm a multitasker. I do way too much. I take on too many things. So when I think about how do I get my exercise in plus get somewhere that I need to be, and I can just do it on a bike. So if I just ride my bike everywhere, which I'm fortunate to do in Chico, I'm getting my exercise taken care of on my way to work or on my way to run errands or on my way to do whatever else I need to do. So I like that you can kind of do both. And it helps you. It helps with transportation. And again, I also do it just for fun as well. So it just does so much for me personally. And I think does have so much overlap in that idea of future sustainability that, yeah, it just makes sense to me.
Thank you so much, Mandy.
Thanks, Whitney.
Celebrating Bike Month is a co-production of Chico Velo and KZFR Radio, 90.1 FM in Chico, California, and at kzfr.org. Post-production by Robert Jones. Our theme music is Midnight Blues by Leva. Celebrating Bike Month is made possible by funding from KZFR supporters and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. To find out more about Chico Velo, visit chicovelo.org. And remember, at Chico Velo, every month is Bike Month.
Genocide says something, not only about Israel, but about us, about Western civilization, about who we are as a people, where we come from, and what defines us. It says that all our vaunted morality and respect for human rights is a lie. It says that people of color, especially when they are poor and vulnerable, do not count. It says we will ensure global domination through racialized violence.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on what the genocide says about us. The Iran-Israel attacks and the prospects of a wider Middle East war have dominated the news. Meanwhile, the bloodbath in Gaza continues. Genocide is the crime of crimes. We're witnessing it in real time in Gaza. The UN says, quote, "The entire population of Gaza is enduring destruction at a scale and speed without parallel in recent history." Nothing, the UN said, can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's promised mighty vengeance quickly became genocide. As Chris Hedges points out, racism enables genocide. He says, "Arabs, like all those with darker skins, are worth less in this moral calculus." This explains the outrage over the murder of 7 employees from the World Central Kitchen and the silence over the killing of over 175 UN Palestinian aid workers. Those who remain silent in the face of genocide are complicit. Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning independent journalist who has covered the Middle East for many years. He's the host of the Chris Hedges Report and the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. He spoke in Newark, California in early April 2024.
There are no surprises in Gaza. Every horrifying act of Israel's genocide has been telegraphed in advance. It has been for decades. The dispossession of Palestinians of their land is the beating heart of Israel's settler colonial project. This dispossession has had dramatic historical moments, 1948 and 1967, when huge parts of historic Palestine were seized and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. Dispossession has also occurred in increments. The slow motion theft of land and steady ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. The incursion on October 7th into Israel by Hamas and other resistance groups, which left 1,154 Israelis, tourists, migrant workers dead, and saw about 240 people taken hostage, gave Israel the pretext for what it has long craved, the total erasure of Palestinians. Israel has raised 77% of healthcare facilities in Gaza, 68% of telecommunications infrastructure, nearly all municipal and governmental buildings, commercial, industrial, and agricultural centers, almost half of all roads, over 60% of Gaza's 439,000 homes, 68% of residential buildings, including the bombing of Al-Taj Tower in Gaza City on October 25th that killed 101 people, including 44 children and 37 women, and injured hundreds, and has obliterated refugee camps. The attack alone on the Jabalia refugee camp on October 25th killed at least 126 civilians, including 69 children, and injured 280. Israel has damaged or destroyed Gaza's universities, all of which are now closed, and 60% of other educational facilities, including 13 libraries. It has also destroyed at least 195 heritage sites, including 208 mosques, churches, and Gaza's central archives that held over 150 years of historical records and documents. Israel's warplanes, missiles, drones, tanks, artillery shells, and naval guns daily pulverize Gaza, which is only 20 miles long and 5 miles wide, in a scorched earth campaign unlike anything seen since the war in Vietnam. It has dropped 250,000 tons of explosives, that's the equivalent of 2 nuclear bombs, on Gaza. Many targets selected by artificial intelligence. It drops unguided munitions known as dumb bombs and 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs on refugee camps and densely packed urban centers, as well as the so-called safe zones. 42% of Palestinians killed have been in these safe zones, where they were instructed to flee. Over 1.7 million Palestinians have been displaced from their homes, forced to find refuge in overcrowded UNRWA shelters, hospital corridors and courtyards, schools, tents, or in the open air in southern Gaza, often living next to fetid pools of raw sewage. Israel's killed at least 32,705 Palestinians in Gaza, including over 13,000 children and 9,000 women. This means Israel is slaughtering as many as 187 people a day, including 75 children. It has killed 136 journalists, many, if not most of them, deliberately targeted. It has killed 340 doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers, 4% of Gaza's healthcare personnel. These numbers do not begin to reflect the actual death toll, since only those dead registered in morgues and hospitals, most of which no longer function, are counted. The death toll when those who are missing are counted is well over 40,000, and 70% are women and children. Doctors are forced to amputate limbs without anesthetic. Those with severe medical conditions, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, have died from lack of treatment or will die soon. Over 100 women give birth every day with little to no medical care. Miscarriages are up by 300%. Over 90% of the Palestinians in Gaza suffer from severe food insecurity, with people eating animal feed and grass. Children are dying of starvation. Palestinian writers, academics, scientists, and their family members have been tracked and assassinated. Over 75,000 Palestinians have been wounded, many of whom will be crippled for life. Israel plays linguistic tricks to claim there are no civilians in Gaza and deny every building, including mosques, hospitals, and schools, protected status. All Palestinians are branded as responsible for the attack on October 7th or written off as human shields for Hamas. All structures are considered legitimate targets because they are allegedly Hamas command centers or harbor Hamas fighters. These accusations, Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestine territory occupied since 1967, writes, are a pretext used to justify, these are her words, the killing of civilians under a cloak of purported legality, whose all-enveloping pervasiveness admits only of genocidal intent. We have never seen an assault on the Palestinians of this magnitude. But every atrocity, the killing of civilians, dispossession of land, arbitrary detention, torture, disappearances, closures imposed on Palestinian towns and villages, house demolitions, revoking residence permits, deportation, destruction of the infrastructure that maintains civil society, military occupation, dehumanizing language, theft of natural resources, especially aquifers, have long defined Israel's campaign to remove Palestinians from historic Palestine. The occupation and genocide would not be possible without the U.S., which gives Israel $3.8 billion a year in military assistance and is now sending another $2.5 billion in bombs, including 1,800 MK-84 2,000-pound bombs, 500 MK-82 500-pound bombs, and fighter jets to Israel. This is not only Israel's genocide, it is ours. The mass killing in Gaza is the culmination of a process. It is not an act. It is the predictable denouement of Israel's settler colonial project. It is coded within the DNA of the Israeli apartheid state. It is where Israel had to end up. Understand this fact, and everything Israel does makes sense. The blockage of humanitarian aid, the sealing off of northern Gaza, the mass starvation, the obliteration of Gaza's infrastructure, the looming assault on Rafah, and the upsurge in violence and land seizures in the West Bank. Israel has allowed 15,413 trucks into Gaza during the past 6 months. Gaza needs five times that number. Israel allowed 2,874 trucks in February, a 44% reduction from the previous month. Israeli soldiers have also killed scores of Palestinians attempting to receive aid from trucks in more than two dozen incidents. These attacks include the killing of at least 21 Palestinians and the wounding of 150 on March 14th, when Israeli forces fired on thousands of people in Gaza City. The same area had been targeted by Israeli soldiers hours before. Israel's assault has caught Gaza's own aid workers and international agencies' partners inside a practically uninhabitable environment of mass displacement and deprivation, where 75% of solid waste is now being dumped in random sites, 97% of groundwater made unfit for human use, and the Israeli state using starvation as a weapon of war, Oxfam states. There is no place in Gaza, Oxfam notes, that is safe amid the forcible and often multiple displacements of almost the entire population, which makes the principal distribution of aid unviable, including agencies' abilities to help repair vital public services at scale. Oxfam blasts Israel for its disproportionate and indiscriminate attacks on civilians and humanitarian assets, as well as solar, water, power, and sanitation plants, UN premises, hospitals, roads, and aid convoys and warehouses, even when these assets are supposedly deconflicted after their coordinates have been shared for protection. None of these Israeli tactics will be altered with the building of a temporary pier. In fact, given the pending assault on Rafah, where 1.2 million displaced Palestinians are crowded in tent cities or camped out in the open air, Israel's tactics are about to get worse. If the Arab world will not take the Palestinian refugees, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken proposed during his first round of visits after October 7th, the Palestinians could well be cast adrift on ships. It worked in Beirut in 1982 when some 8,500 Palestinian Liberation Organization members were sent by sea to Tunis or Tunisia, and another 2,500 ended up in other Arab states. Israel, for this reason, supports the temporary pier the Biden administration is building to ostensibly deliver food and aid to Gaza, food and aid whose distribution will be overseen by the Israeli military. You need drivers that don't exist, trucks that don't exist, feeding into a distribution system that doesn't exist. Jeremy Kneidek, a former senior aid official in the Biden administration and now president of the Refugees International Aid Advocacy Group, told The Guardian. The small shipments of seaborne aid, like the food packets that have been airdropped, will not alleviate the looming famine. They are not meant to. They are cynical pieces of theater used to mask the orchestrated mass starvation. Israel is creating a humanitarian crisis of such catastrophic proportions, with thousands of Palestinians killed by bombs, shells, missiles, bullets, starvation, and infectious diseases, that the only option will soon be death or deportation. The pier, perhaps, is where the last act in this gruesome genocidal campaign will be played out as Palestinians are herded by Israeli soldiers onto ships. Or perhaps Washington will be able to buy off the Egyptian government to expel Palestinians to the Sinai. Whatever the outcome, the Biden administration, without whom this genocide could not be carried out, will facilitate it. Zionist leaders are quite open about their goals. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant announced that Gaza would receive, quote, no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs, Israel Katz, said, humanitarian aid to Gaza? No electrical switch will be turned on. No water hydrant will be opened. Avi Dichter, the Minister of Agriculture, referred to Israel's military assault as the Gaza Nakba, referring, of course, to the catastrophe which between 1947 and 1949 drove 750,000 Palestinians from their land and saw thousands massacred by Zionist militias. Likud member of the Knesset, Revital Gottlieb, posted on her social media account, bring down buildings, bomb without distinction, flatten Gaza without mercy. This time, there is no room for mercy. Not to be outdone, Minister of Heritage Amichai Eliyahu supported using nuclear weapons on Gaza as, quote, one of the possibilities. The message from the Israeli leadership is unequivocal. Annihilate the Palestinians the same way we annihilated Native Americans. The Australians annihilated the First Nations peoples. The Germans annihilated the Herero in Namibia. The Turks annihilated the Armenians, and the Nazis annihilated Jews. The specifics are different, The process is the same. And we cannot plead ignorance. We know what happened to the Palestinians. We know what is happening to the Palestinians. And we know what will happen to the Palestinians. But it is easier to pretend. Pretend Israel will allow in humanitarian aid. Pretend there will be a ceasefire. Pretend Palestinians will return to their destroyed homes in Gaza. Pretend Gaza will be rebuilt. Pretend the Palestine Authority will administer Gaza. Pretend there will be a two-state solution. Pretend there is no genocide. The genocide says something, not only about Israel, but about us, about Western civilization, about who we are as a people, where we come from, and what defines us. It says that all our vaunted morality and respect for human rights is a lie. It says that people of color, especially when they are poor and vulnerable, do not count. It says that their hopes, dreams, dignity, and aspirations for freedom are worthless. It says we will ensure global domination through racialized violence. This lie that Western civilization is predicated on values such as respect for human rights and the rule of law is one the Palestinians and all those in the global South, as well as Native Americans and Black and Brown Americans, have known for centuries. But with the Gaza genocide live streamed, this lie is becoming very hard to sustain. We do not halt Israel genocide because we are Israel, infected with white supremacy and intoxicated by our domination of the globe's wealth and the power to obliterate others with our industrial weapons. Remember the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman telling Charlie Rose on the eve of the war in Iraq that American soldiers should go house to house from Basra to Baghdad and say, these are his words, to Iraqis, suck on this. And this is the real credo of the American empire. The world outside of the industrial fortresses in the global north is acutely aware that the fate of the Palestinians is their fate. As climate change imperils survival, as resources become scarce, as migration becomes an imperative for millions, as agricultural yields decline, as coastal areas are flooded, as droughts and wildfires proliferate, as states fail, as armed resistance movements rise to battle their oppressors along with their proxies, genocide will not be an anomaly, it will be the norm. The Earth's vulnerable and poor, those Frantz Fanon call the wretched of the Earth, will be the next Palestinians. Genocide always requires the active participation of educated professionals, physicians, scientists, engineers, military leaders, lawyers, clergy, university professors, who, as Robert J. Lifton points out, create not only the technology of genocide, but much of its ideological rationale, moral climate, and organizational process. A group of 100 Israeli doctors in November 2023 defended the bombing of hospitals in Gaza, claiming they were used as Hamas command centers, a charge Israel has been unable to verify. The deans of U.S. medical schools and leading medical organizations, especially the American Medical Association, have joined the ranks of universities, law schools, churches, and the media to turn their backs on the Palestinians. The AMA shut down a debate on a ceasefire resolution among its members and has called for medical neutrality, although there was no medical neutrality when it denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There is a cost to denouncing genocide, a cost they do not intend to pay. They fear being attacked. They fear destroying their careers. They fear losing funding. They fear a loss of status. They fear persecution. They fear social isolation. This fear makes them complicit. And what of those who do speak out? They are branded as anti-Semites and supporters of terrorism. George Washington University clinical psychology professor Laura Sheehy was pushed out of her job. The former head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, was denied a fellowship at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy because of his alleged, quote, anti-Israel bias. San Francisco professor Rabab Abdelhada was sued for supporting Palestinian rights. Medical students and faculty in Canada are being suspended or expelled if they publicly criticize Israel. Dr. Rupa Mara, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, called for a halt to the bombing of hospitals and the examination of the impact of Zionism as a racist ideology. This led to vitriolic attacks against her, attacks tacitly endorsed by the medical school where she works. She has been slandered as an anti-Semite and targeted by the Canary Mission, a Zionist organization that seeks to defame and destroy the careers of students and faculty that criticize Israel and defend Palestinian rights. She has had speaking engagements rescinded and received death threats. The danger is not only that the Israeli crimes are denounced. The danger, more importantly, is that the moral bankruptcy and the cowardice of our own institutions and politicians are exposed. Those who promote this genocide have no rational or humane arguments to offer the public, only character assassination and censorship. The dehumanization of Palestinians is lifted from this racist playbook, the playbook of all settler colonial projects, including our own. It is why the two ruling parties sustain Israel's occupation and genocide. Arabs, like all those with darker skins, are worth less in this moral calculus. This explains the outrage over the murder of 7 employees from Global Central Kitchen and the silence over the murder of over 175 staff from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Global Central Kitchen, unlike UNRWA, which has seen its U.S. funding cut, does not have the logistic capacity to provide the food needed to alleviate the famine. Israel and Washington's support for Global Central Kitchen is part of the campaign to destroy UNRWA. Several humanitarian aid groups in Gaza after the killings have suspended operations. This suspension advances Israel's goal of a complete blockage of food to starving Palestinians. Let me end tonight by speaking about Aaron Bushnell, who lit himself on fire in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., resulting in his death. He pitted divine violence against the radical evil we witness in Gaza. As an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force, he was part of the vast machinery that sustains the genocide in Gaza, no less morally culpable than the German soldiers, technocrats, engineers, scientists, and bureaucrats who oiled the apparatus of the Nazi Holocaust. This was a role he could no longer accept. "I will no longer be complicit in genocide," he said calmly in his video as he walked to the gate of the embassy. "I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest. But compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their coloners, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal."
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us. He spoke in Newark, California in early April 2024. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist who's covered the Middle East for many years. He's the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And we have a series of programs with Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org.